As Tomas said, I've been active in INFORMS. This is my fourth year on the advisory board for the INFORMS Practice Conference, which is going to be held April 17th through 19th in Palm Springs, California. So it's really nice place this year. So I highly recommend that you, if possible, attend. It's a nice location. We've always had wonderful speakers. All speakers are selected. We review their talks, so you don't get the random, you know, nonsense that they actually, and the talks are 50 minutes, so you actually get a chance to learn something. This is my new email address and phone number. I left Shell last Thursday. It's been so fast I haven't even gotten business cards printed yet. But I will leave copies of these slides with Tomas that you can distribute them wherever you want or whoever's interested. Okay. As Leon said, I'm going to talk about refinery planning models. I was part of a team that started in 1986. Starting from scratch, we built our own planning model, our own planning system, actually. It was built using GAMS for a model development system, as opposed to everything else in the industry at that time. It was predicated on a modeling system that could generate linear programs. We went to GAMS because we knew that the oil and chemical industry is not linear mathematically. The natural world is exponential. Whether you like it or not, the natural world is exponential. And so we started with a system from scratch that could handle these nonlinear functions if we wanted to put them in. So which was pretty radical actually for that time, because there weren't very many good solvers. In fact, as we started, we used to have some real problems. The first couple models we generated, which we generated as linear models, our current software, which we started with MPSX, and then we used a solver called Wizard from Ketron. Some of you may or may not remember that. I think Leon does. It wouldn't solve them. And then, as I'll show as we get into this, IBM was nice enough to come out with OSL, which saved our life. Refinery planning models. They're large models. Refineries are big, complex operations. They've got, most of the large ones will have up to 25 process units. They have massive yield tables. As you put feed in, you get up to 25 products coming out the other side of each one of these 25 units. Ultimately, you end up with about 30 major products coming out the back end of a refinery, but you may have 30 different crude oils coming in the front end. The models that get built always have a lot of redundant constraints, just extra constraints. They're so big and complex that it's just too hard to try to go in and really clean them up like you would if you were writing C code to build the model. But if you're writing C code to build the model, you need an army of people to keep the thing current. It just isn't possible. With these modeling languages, we often would generate a lot of redundant constraints and redundant variables, for that matter. And everybody's models are that way. Even the cleanest ones are that way. It goes with the territory. They're too big. Any really, really large model, I've never seen a really, really large model, optimization model, that doesn't have redundant constraints. The chemical process industries, the refining chemical business, nearly all of our models are poorly scaled. We have We got volume that we got to worry about, but then we got physical properties that we got to worry about, and things like energy. You know, you might have millions of BTUs, and the volume is 500 barrels. So you've got these massive scale differences in the equations. So that's these two are what caused us all kinds of problems when we first got started. Then there's a classic problem in the oil industry called the pooling problem, which is inherently non-convex. If I have time at the end, I'll try to draw you a picture on the board. But it is inherently non-convex. I've got some papers that Leon wrote back, 1984, 85 time frame, where he did all kinds of studies of it. And we figured out some slick ways. We figured out some reasons why it didn't cause us as many problems as we thought it would. But it still is there, and every once in a while it would bite us. These problems have long flat optima, so it's very difficult to decide. You could have two solutions that gave you up to about 8 or 9 digits, the same answer, and the flows in the refinery would be massively different, which really didn't matter as long as we were making the right amount of money. But it makes converging these things kind of difficult sometimes. You're not really sure when you should stop. And then because of, for various reasons, this is not only non-convex, but it's nonlinear. There's other places where nonlinearities show up, in particular in our final product blending. And some of that's actually dictated by the state that we're selling the gasoline in. It looks easy, right? You want to maximize revenue minus cost. In theory, profits, but it's not really profit. It's the variable profit for operations. You've got a whole bunch of constraints really on production. You have all the grades of gasoline, there's multiple grades of diesel, there's jet fuel, I'm going to leave these here, so don't try to copy these slides. It's going to waste your time. The main products are gasoline and diesel, which is where refining makes its money. The rest of it is because we've got to do something with the rest of the crude oil. It's too expensive to burn it, and you can't dump it on the ground. We got fuel oil, we have bunker fuel. We take some cuts for certain kinds of crude and make lube oils out of them that you buy to put in your gasoline. There's also a whole other class of industrial lubricants, greases, heavy-duty oils, and so on for heavy-duty engines, and so on. But the big products and what we're always trying to make is out of this real heavy, the heavy ends of a crude oil, we try to break it apart into smaller molecules so we can make either diesel or gasoline out of it, because that's where the dollars are. But when we start running these models, we've got to meet these demands. We've got to determine what crudes to buy, what crude oil, what feedstock we have to buy. Now, an oil refinery is the exact opposite of almost any other manufacturing you will ever see. If you're making cars, automobiles, the auto companies go out and buy parts. They'll have contracts with people to make fenders and engines and all of these other parts that go into a car, and basically the manufacturing then is to assemble them. Even the engines, they're cast, then you put the parts in them. You put the cylinders and all of that kind of stuff in them. The oil industry, just the opposite. We start out by buying crude oil, and then the first thing we do is separate it into components. Not actual individual chemicals, but we separate it into usually temperature cuts. Okay, very different. Now, there's something like 450 known different crude oils in the world. Shell uses about 250 of them. We used on the Texas Gulf Coast about 40 of them in our refineries at various times of the year. So what we're trying to do, and by the way, when I say different crude oils, that means they have different chemical structure, and they work better or worse in some different kinds of refineries. There's been something like 2,700 organic chemicals, unique chemical species identified in crude oil. And when you get down to the real gunky stuff, like if you've ever been to the La Brea tar pits in Los Angeles, that's like we get in the bottom end of the heavy end of the barrel. That stuff's so heavy that in order to heat it up enough to try to find out what the real chemicals are, the molecules break. So we really don't know what's down there. So what we're trying to do here is to minimize our cost, we're trying to determine what crude oil to buy in what volume for the next month. And that's really the big decision we got to make. For a standard size refinery, that at least when you look at, you're talking maybe 100,000 barrels of that crude oil every day. That's about $11.5 million every day in raw materials that we bring in. With multiple refineries, we do actually move intermediate streams between the refineries. So there's a whole big piece of the refinery planning model about shipments between our refineries. Then there's a whole bunch of constraints about what we can feed to each one of these 25 process units. They've got limits. Unique feature of refining, and I gave a talk yesterday about this, but a unique feature of working in the oil industry and actually chemicals for that matter, most of these process units won't run unless you've got at least 70% of their design capacity coming in at feed. So that means you got to shut them down, and that's not good. They just don't work right. So you've got to do some planning to make sure you're getting at least 70%. That's a ballpark figure, but then on the output side, we make products, and all products coming out of an oil refinery are blended. They're blends of something. Gasoline is a blend of about 8 or 9 different out of 8 or 9 different product out of tanks. There's heavy stuff, there's light stuff. That means lighter burning, higher vapor pressure, heavier stuff. Our blends are different in the wintertime. Our blends are different if in Shell Canada, for example, or what we're shipping into the northern United States than we ship in the Gulf Coast. What we send into the northern United States in the summertime in Houston, you get vapor lock in your car with. Which, you know, makes customers rather unhappy. But this is basically what a refinery planning model looks like. Now, there's, you know, the modeling system we built would generated about 100,000 lines of GAMS code after we put all the data in it. This was for 3 refineries in a region. So it ended up with about 100,000 lines of GAMS code. We had another 100,000 lines of GAMS code to generate reports. And to make one of these multiple refinery runs, we would pull in about 400,000 records out of a database with all the data that would go into this model. This is for 3 refineries now. But the beauty of the set-based languages like GAMS is we could generate 500 to 1,000 lines of that with just one GAMS statement. That's why those things are nice. You know, I could print out the code for the whole model in about 40 pages. But when it would expand and generate all the equations running over all these different domains, like the example that, that Professor Lansden showed, it would end up about 100,000 lines. Why do we use GAMs? At the time, this was the late 80s, GAMs was really the only thing available that had we considered commercial quality. Ames wasn't available. Ample wasn't available. No, Ample was available. In fact, we looked seriously at Ample. OPL wasn't available. MPL wasn't available. But Ample was available, but it really wasn't. It was one of the early version of Ample, so it really wasn't commercial quality. In fact, David Gay and Bob Forer said wouldn't recommend that we'd use it. So GAMS, this was right at the time that Alex Mierhaus was leaving the World Bank, setting up his own company. And so we got very good service for fixing it. We wanted to use GAMS so we weren't limited with the type of model we could build. Because a modeling system like this has interfaces to a large number of solvers, if we built a pure linear program model, and there were some situations where we did that, it would call a linear programming system directly. If we put some mixed integer variables in there, it would call the right solver to solve a mixed integer linear or mixed integer nonlinear model. Now, if you're doing this the hard way, writing C code, or at that time possibly Fortran code, it can take you forever to build those interfaces. So that was the fact that we could build these models of almost any kind we wanted, and as we experimented a lot over time. We did some experiments with SLP that Ben didn't even know about. But that was a good decision at the time, probably better than we really knew. Even today, people are fighting these refinery planning systems because they know they've got nonlinearities, and the systems have been built based assuming that you're going to have a linear program, and they don't know what to do with them. And that's going. This is 20 years later almost. Then we get to the solvers. Why did we use SLP? Well, the beauty of linear programming, and particularly with the timing of IBM coming out with OSL, was, and number one, I was the original tester on the continuous part of OSL. A friend of mine, Alex Johnson, was doing some consulting for American Airlines at the time. He tested the MIP part. OSL was the first commercial linear programming system that had a preprocessor. I mean, many of you are way too young to understand solving complex linear programs without a preprocessor, but we tried for many, many years. With redundant constraints, with those redundancies in there, that preprocessor could strip out just all kinds of stuff. It made it solvable. And even today, nonlinear codes don't do a good job of any of that preprocessing. There is some preprocessing in CONOP, but it's very primitive. There is some scaling in CONOP, it's very primitive, but LPs automatically scale. So we got rid of the scaling problem, we got rid of redundancies, and so it was the natural solution to make use of that feature that was in the LP in the first place, which is there by default in a successive linear programming. I think when Leon was doing his original development, you had your own linear programming solver, if I'm not mistaken. Or which one did you use? Oh yeah, XMP, yeah. But that wasn't really Right. It's really not hard to write that penalty SLP algorithm if you've got a callable LP library like OSL was. You can just make the calls into external to the LP. You can load the data. You can set all of the trust region parameters, and away you go. And just make a bunch of calls into the library, and you'll come out with a solution. Grab those numbers, I think it took us about a month to write and test our SLP, because we didn't have, you know, it's just a black box to us. You just call solve and it would solve the LP. The other advantage, the real advantage of me doing this testing, was that we were using it commercially before it was available commercially. We had a good year's head start on everybody else. Now this is not a problem. There's a number you can do this. OSL actually is, I think it's off the market now. Although I know IBM's still using it internally. But Cplex and I believe Express also has this callable library. So you can, and now they're coming out with their own SLP codes. So the only real logic we had to write was right here. You know, handling those trust region parameters for convergence. And that was really not too difficult. Obviously, and reporting was mostly done through GAMS code. And we did do some external work setting up parametric runs, which I'll talk about in a minute. Yeah. Okay, this is the stuff I don't think Leanne's seen before. Okay. After we got the thing running, then we started playing with it, which is really what the most fun was. We found that with these problems that we had, they were large, a lot of nonlinearities, but it was mostly nonlinear pools, which are non-convex, that if we would periodically open the trust region and take the step bounds off the trust region and let it go wherever it wanted to. Ultimately what we did is we let the LP, instead of letting it make the step, we'd let it pick a direction. And then we'd do a search in that direction. Okay? So we didn't really open it up totally, but we'd open it up to let it pick a direction and then do a search to keep it feasible. Made a big difference on a lot of our problems. And that was especially true in the early parts of a solution when it was a long ways from optimality. It solved a lot of these problems getting trapped, because most of the time in any commercial operation, you try to use an advanced solution to start. But if the parameters, or if the model has changed a lot, you may get trapped by the old solution and never really get out. So that worked, we never studied the theoretical properties. We didn't care. All we cared about was it worked. OSL eventually had an interior point algorithm, which works well on really large LPs, and it's quite robust, and it truly, you know, a linear program follows the boundaries. Okay, the interior point by definition goes through the middle. So we also found, after, you know, another one of our little playing games, that in the early iterations, when we were a long ways from the solution, that the taking 5 to 10 passes using the interior point algorithm in OSL, speed it up, would get us in the area of a solution much faster, and then switch over to the simplex algorithm. You know, again, well, we knew why it worked. It worked because it was very, it was quite robust when you didn't know much about the solution and when things were changing a lot. But as you got close to a solution, the interior point algorithm really didn't know you were closer, so that it'd have to go through all this computation, and it slowed it down. Now, we also, of course, tried things that didn't work, which may work now. We were solving these problems on the fastest machine we ever used, a 350 megahertz RS6000. I'd love to run some of these on 3 gigahertz machines. And I do have the code, so sometime I may do that. This is one of the things that didn't work that we tried. OSL did have a capability that John Forrest put in. It was really put in there because he did build a parallel processor version of the code. But we could use it with a single processor, that we would try to make the problem smaller by solving each of the time periods separately. And then when you've got the theory is, if you've got a good solution to each time period, bring them all together and you're close to a solution for the overall problem. Unfortunately, we weren't close to the solution to the overall problem. And so it didn't work. I think there's probably things I could do to make it work, but we didn't have time at that time. We just were off on something else. Yes? Well, ultimately, yeah, it would be. I mean, it's really set up. If we could have made it work, ultimately, we could have used multiple processors. Because really, you've got three time periods, and in our case, we had three refineries. So if you had nine computers, you could solve all nine of those at the same time, in parallel, to get you a really, in theory, a good starting solution for solving the overall problem. We never had time to get to that point. But what was happening was that we would take the three solutions that had come out of this case and then feed it in as the initial solution for the overall problem, and that took longer to solve than just starting from scratch the overall problem. I know it sounds crazy, doesn't it? But there's a lot of overhead and you're moving a lot of numbers around. I won't say that this wouldn't be better, and I'm sure it probably would now. There's been a big improvement in the LP codes, both on the interior point side and the simplex side. So, but at the time, it didn't work. But you know, there's a somewhat limited time to test it. I don't know how many of you are aware of the way supply chain planning works. In some senses, it works this way, whether you're in manufacturing or whether you're in the chemical business or whether you're in the mining business or whether you're in refineries. I don't think I'll spend a whole lot of time on this. Suffice it to say that the big decisions we made were selecting crudes. Find the right crude at the right price is where you make your money. And then who's going to ship what products to what customers. That's what Walmart does. That's what the auto companies do. That's what your steel companies around here do. We all do it. The difference is how we build the models to make those decisions. in the single refinery. Then we'd turn the results over to the single refineries, and as they went through the month, they'd keep updating to make sure something different didn't happen. And periodically, we'd have to go back and replan the whole region. If there's a major crude price change, or one of our major processing units broke, we'd have to reallocate a whole bunch of things between refineries, and that meant you had to go back to the regional model. The other thing we did a lot of, and I'm not sure Leon was aware of all this either, we did a lot of parametric analysis, and this was done on a monthly basis. It wasn't just once in a while. We wanted to make sure that our monthly refinery plan was robust. One way to do that was to run parametric cases on crude prices. What we did is we take what we considered the standard crude price, go back $2, and run a case with all the prices drop by $2 a barrel, and then in 50-cent increments go up to the standard price plus $2 a barrel. And if you got significantly different answers, okay, we'd go in and spend some time understanding why they're different. The same thing was true for gasoline prices, since the way we made most of our money was selling gasoline. And again, if over this range of prices, if there was some drop-off point where the crude slate or something changed significantly, we might... There's two possibilities. One, to find out why. The second was it was just automatic, and so if we saw that prices would start creeping up like that, we would change what we were supposed to buy or change our operations to follow it. We'd put these things in, and they'd run all night. And then the next morning, the people would come back, and they'd have thousands of lines of reports to look at. Here was our computer networks. I was a good friend of IBM at the time, since I bought all these computers. These were run in batch. At that time, we run them in batch. We had our own batch scheduler. The regional three refinery model would take between an hour and 3 hours of CPU time, depending on how much was new and how good the advanced basis was and how many changes we had from the last one. The refinery runs usually took 30 to 60 minutes. The biggest problem I knew they solved was a 12-period model for one of our refineries that was evaluating a new crude oil that they'd never run before, over the summer and winter gasoline period. So it's 12 periods. I think it had something like 130,000 constraints, roughly the same number of variables. It took about 6 CPU hours to solve. But it did solve. And on those RS6000, since we already owned them, CPU time was free, just like all the CPU time on all your computers sitting in your offices, sitting there overnight, you've got more computing power doing nothing than we used to have available in the whole research center. So we would do some batch stuff at night too, some overnight runs, but this is pretty standard. There's a lot of things you can do with this stuff that I'd like to try in my retirement. But I'm going to, at this point, cut it off. And if you've got questions, it was a very good implementation of an algorithm that I'm sure glad was developed before we needed it. We have tried, and I know a lot of people that have tried solving these planning models with ConOpt and SQP and so on. They just don't work worth a darn because you don't have the good preprocessor and you don't handle the scaling very well. To use those algorithms, you've got to really more fine-tune the model. than we were willing to do in these big complex refinery models. Questions? Comments?
Question.
Yes. Talked about it and we played around with it, but remember this was back in the late 80s, early 90s, and these computers weren't capable of doing a very good job, and stochastic programming wasn't nearly at the level it is now from a modeling standpoint. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, in reality, I've never convinced any of our management to do it, but I think we should be running these things on a continuous basis. We've got the databases that can tell us when demands are satisfied, we ship to an order. Why not just update the whole damn thing every 3-4 hours? But, you know, what it is, my view of this, the way it should be, it's a control system with a long time passing.
Dave, do you remember? There was an effort made to market a scenario-based stochastic programming scheme for refinery planning by a company called Chesapeake Decision Sciences.
Okay.
That was Tom Baker's company.
Right.
He had robust optimization in his MIMI system.
Mm-hmm.
And he found it to be a very hard sell. I wasn't one of the salespeople, so I don't know. But, you know, evidently, that it was just hard to convince people that they should try to form scenarios of the
uncertain
quantities and solve the problem. He had a really nice user guide. I see
what happened. Oh, I do too. I'll tell you that I think the real reason it didn't fly too much, and we had the same problem. The people we were working with in the refinery understood the refinery, and they understood very clearly when a solution came back that didn't make sense. Okay? So, doubling the size of the problem, if they were going to make the problem bigger, they wanted more detail in certain other areas like blending, rather than spend their time looking at some of this, what they considered abstract stuff. When you're working with people that really understand the underlying process and problem, a lot of the tools that we have in the OR arsenal really aren't necessary. Because these people know when you give them a solution that makes sense or when it's not. That's one of the reasons this non-convex pooling problem didn't cause us any problem, because they could take one look at the results of We generated some reports that were sort of an overview report, and they could take a look at this two-page report and tell us if the refinery plan made sense by looking at, you know, a few hundred numbers, really. So we didn't have a problem with some of the places that could be problems, because we were working with very knowledgeable people about their underlying technology. It makes a big difference. And if you're doing things like the National Energy Model, where you really don't know what's going on, yeah, it makes very good sense to look at things like stochastic programming and so on.
So you mentioned the GitLab solutions, which are almost identical.
Well, yeah, but they made sense. They were logical. You had different flows going into different units, but as long as they were, basically you didn't have different volumetric flows, you had slightly different property of the streams going into different units. You would buy different crudes, but those crudes made sense because they were in the model in the first place. We're talking about, remember a model that's based on a monthly time period is an abstract from reality in the first place. Okay. As soon as you take that monthly time period and break it into weeks, you have added constraints to that model, so you will always get a lower optimum than you had in the monthly model, because you've added constraints to the model. And as you go to daily scheduling, which is another layer in this decision hierarchy, you're actually adding a whole bunch of constraints to the point where actually most refineries look at scheduling, daily scheduling, as a feasibility issue, not an economic issue. Okay. You look at the multipliers, the simplex multipliers coming out of these problems. I don't ever see this talked about, but a multiplier has a time component on it. The multipliers that we would get out of the monthly model were very different than the multipliers we get out of the weekly model. I mean, on the same stream, the multiplier in the weekly model may be above or below or both over a 4-week month. It depends on when it was important to make that component. People don't talk about this, but it's there. And some weeks, and in any time period based optimization problem, and this is where simulation becomes important. Continuous time, discrete event simulation. In an optimization model with time periods, the only points in time when you know anything about the solution is at the start of the model, which is the start of the time period. The assumption is all of your intakes come in at the start of the time period, and all of the products leave at the end of the period, the end of the model. You have you know nothing about what's going on in between. That's why you got to be careful how you use time period based optimization models, because you can shoot yourself in the foot very easily. Actually, you know, if we were buying 200,000 barrels a day of crude, but in the model it shows that all of that stuff's coming in at the first of the month. In our monthly model, well, you know, we don't want to store a month's worth of crude. We're tying up too much money. So there's some things that I don't ever see written up in journal articles about these kind of models. But there's some people like me, like Tom Baker, that have spent our life working with this kind of stuff. And there's a lot of implicit stuff that they don't tell you. You know, we're making assumptions when we don't know we're making assumptions. Yes?
So the sequential linear programming approach, you said that sometimes you were solving it initially with the intermediate point method and then crossing over to the simple. So the intermediate point method is very
important.
How do you make the swap from
intermediate
point?
Hey, now you meant you were applying the interior point method to the LP, not to the
NLP. Right. It was to the LP. But it would be, we floated with this, but it was, we run like 5 SLP iterations, like solve the first 5 LPs with the interior point algorithm. And then the 6th one, we'd switch over to the simplex method after we generated the new LP. Well,
once the warm spot got important, then
switch. Somewhere I've got slides showing, I've got data showing if you look at number of LP iterations versus SLP. All right, let's just say SLP number. Okay? You'd start out really high, and you'd run fairly level. I mean, these may be up in the 100,000 LP iterations. Okay? And then after you'd gone 4 or 5 SLP iterations, these things would start dropping off rather dramatically until you got fairly close to a solution, and then they would go out like this. And we might have solutions out here that that required 10 LP iterations. And the whole point of that was to do nothing but converge that that trust region so it was small enough to satisfy our convergence criteria. Pivots. LP pivots. It was in this region that we were able to use the interior point effectively. Because once we start getting down here, so we were taking fewer pivots, well, I mean, obviously you don't talk about pivots with the interior point, but I mean, we'd run them both ways and see which took the longest. Then you could make use of the prior solution as we went into the next SLP iteration, and we'd start converging. This wasn't scientific. This was just good practical. And if we'd run somebody, 6 months later, we might want to run 10 interior point because they'd made enough changes. The model got enough more complex. You know, it's basically whatever worked. The key was, though, we didn't care how long it took to compute, but by God, we wanted it to solve. That was robustness is the name of the game. Okay. And yeah, exactly. It was just considered a solution. We come back out, go through the magic of the SLP and linearize the problem again and go back in. And either solve it, we either continued with the interior point or switched over to simplex. And OSL had a nice switch to do that. So it wasn't that hard. You know, basically you'd flip one parameter from 0 to 1 the way you'd go. So, I mean, now with the current crop of interior point algorithms, we could probably run it a lot farther. But I do know that, well, for one thing, our customers wanted the LP simplex solution. They wanted those corner point solutions because they were more they understood the multipliers coming out of those, and they actually used them a lot. So, but once you got down here, it was the LP. You sit there and watch it. You could watch it on the screen. They just flip over, just ping, 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 ping. You know, a couple hundred LP iterations away go. But, you know, a lot of this would be a whole bunch of fun if I could do it again.
You
can. Generally not. We generate a report, let the guys in the refinery look at it. And they'd say, nope. But we didn't really have that problem very, very often, to be very honest with you, because there's really a couple reasons. When people explore the pooling problem, this non-convex piece of model, they tend to explore it in isolation. We had demands on products that required that zero was not an option on flow through certain nodes. Okay, we had to have flow there. We couldn't not have flow. So, number one, the initial solution always had flow. Number two, if you really look at some of these flow rates that in the refinery, as the model would solve, you wouldn't be moving the flow rates very much. You might change the flow rate, the properties of that flow rate, by in effect moving in material from a different crude. you were adjusting the properties for more than the volumes. A volume, you know, in chemical engineering, first thing we learn is about material balances. What goes in got to come out. Okay. Well, that's true about the properties of these streams too. Okay. So most of what went on in these solutions really was adjusting the properties, which reflected back in which crude you'd buy, because the crude oils had very different properties. And we learned this. It took us a long time to learn this, but from just watching and looking at hundreds and hundreds of these runs and watching them solve. You think all this magic's going on, but it's moving flow rates a little bit, and it's changing property, moving properties all over the refinery, stream properties. Because when we blend gasoline to 20 different properties. You know, you're familiar with octane because you see that on the pump. But there's a whole raft of other properties that we have to meet to satisfy the powers that be, like the California Air Resources Board, the EPA in the U.S. And we have totally different grades of gasoline summer and winter. Totally different. Those properties change. In fact, our properties change every month. But then there's a massive change summer to winter. Mostly because of vapor pressure. And then, of course, the reformulated gasoline in the U.S. to reduce emissions of NOx and sulfur compounds. So, but you watch these things solve. It's really fascinating. It's frustrating as hell because you can't see quite as much as you really like to. You know, every time you figure out how, I'd love to sit there with about 10 monitors, each one of them showing me half a dozen of these things